Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Should we abolish the lottery?
I think it's time. I don't think it's going to happen.
You think we should get rid of state lotteries?
I think we do. I think we should. The gambling will continue. I make no, you know, jokes about that. You know, people are going to keep betting, but there is no way, you know, without the cooperation of a state government or these companies, that Americans are going to bet $98 billion a year on lottery tickets. And, you know, the 5%, 1% of players are still going to find a way to play. But ultimately, these games are not serving the common good. And in fact, I think are doing more harm than good overall.
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Happening? With me, your host, Chris Hayes. There's a new Republican Congress you may have heard about. And after, you know, a lot of back and forth, Kevin McCarthy is now leading the House Republican Caucus. And one of the first things they did was vote on a rules package, which is a little obscure, but actually ends up pretty important because it's the kind of guiding, governing language for how the House is going to proceed. One of the things they did in there was that they made it harder to raise taxes. They basically put in a bunch of thresholds and procedural mechanisms that make it harder to raise taxes. This is a sort of favorite standard thing that Republicans do and Republican governance tends to do. They tend to be laser focused on making it harder to raise taxes and cutting taxes whenever they get a chance. And this is part of 40 plus years of what's called the tax revolt. It goes back to Reagan and, of course, Grover Norquist and the Americans for Tax Reform, who made all the Republican members sign this pledge that they couldn't raise taxes. And it's been incredibly successful. At the state level, particularly, it's been very successful. Of course, the problem is that you got to fund the government. So what happens when you make it harder and harder to raise taxes, particularly income taxes, which tend to be fairly progressive in their distribution, is you got to find the revenue somewhere. Now, the federal government doesn't have to find the revenue somewhere because the federal government can borrow. And so the federal government is way less constrained by what happens in the tax revolt in the last 20 or 30 or 40 years than the states. But the states, particularly states that are run by conservative government, but not exclusively that, all states, often find themselves in a situation where they have to solve for the following problem. We need more revenue and people don't like taxes and we can't raise taxes. So what should we do? And into this picture comes something called the lottery. See, the lottery is a way that you can raise revenue for your state, but you don't have to tax anyone. And over the last several decades, generation really, probably around from the same time, we have seen an explosion in lotteries. You will note if you watch local television how much advertising goes into whatever your local lottery is. In my case, it's the New York Lottery. You'll be amazed at the many different forms of gambling now offered to you by the lottery. It's not just one drawing, but then there's the Powerball, and then there's like a million different scratch tickets and things like that, a million different options. And year over year, lotteries have grown and grown and grown. And they kind of stand outside often policy analysis. There's some great vague sense that like, oh, well, the lottery money goes to education. Great. That's not quite really the full story. And in fact, the lottery is a strange thing too, because as I'm writing this book about attention, one of the things that struck me is that the lottery is one of the lone like attention commanding institutions left, along with maybe the NFL and like a presidential race, where when Powerball gets up to a big enough number, everyone in the country knows this. People talk about it. It can kind of like reach out into people's attention in a way that very few things can anymore. So I thought it'd be great to kind of like peel back the curtain a little bit on the lottery and state lotteries and how they function and whether they're a good idea or not. And we have just the guest for that today, Jonathan Cohen, who's author of For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. He's a program officer at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And John, it's great to have you in the program.
Thanks for having me.
How'd you get interested in lotteries?
I'm a child of the Great Recession. You know, it came up. That was a sort of formative political moment for me as a 16-year-old, 17-year-old. And so went to graduate school sort of interested in inequality, American dream, opportunity. And then, you know, the real answer is that I'm a board gamer by disposition and sort of willing as a result to take games and entertainment, I think, more seriously. You know, there's an old adage, gamblers don't read and readers don't gamble. And so maybe that sort of board game background helped me peel back that curtain a little bit, as you said.
What do you mean by, like, what is your gaming interest?
Like those 3-hour European board games that, you know, destroy friendships and, or like put them to sleep because everyone is like barely conscious by the end.
Wait, like what? Like Catan or like, what are we talking here?
So Catan is great, but there's this huge element of luck, right? Because of all of the dice. So imagine a game sort of, I don't know, 3 times as complicated that in order to compensate for the removal of luck just has to add layers and layers and layers of rules. And I know I'm cognizant of the fact that I write a book about the lottery and now I'm talking about games that don't have any luck built into them. But something of that sort, you know, I'll just call out Terra Mystica, which is one of my favorites, or Scythe, which have sort of elements of luck and sort of in the way that chess has luck, where you can sort of, you can't really predict what the other person is going to do and you can assume that they're being rational, but maybe they're not actually because, you know, no one plays like a computer.
Terra Mystica and Scythe, these are board games.
These are board games. Very highly rated on BoardGameGeek.com, as I'm sure you know.
So you've combined your love of games with the interest in inequality that's brought you to the lotteries. Give me the history. What's the first lottery? When did lotteries start?
Well, I mean, if you open up your Bible, there's some lots in there, the drawing of lots, you know, to determine land allocation, to determine the recipient of Jesus's garments following the crucifixion.
Yep.
You know, they hold a whole little lottery right there.
They have like a dice game, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And there's even a record of a game board recovered from a Roman war camp that has a little inscription on the top thanking or asking for Jesus's help to win games of chance.
Wow.
So we'll put up the connection of faith and gambling. We can put that aside for a quick second. But in terms of a civic functionality, you know, lotteries are popular in Roman times sort of as like a party gift. You determine your prizes based on the drawing. But then as a civic function, as far as I can tell, you know, 15th century Belgium is when they're first used to, you know, raise money for government.
Wow. How did they figure that out? What was the lottery in 15th century Belgium?
So this is true in 15th century Belgium. It's also true in, you know, 16th, 17th century England, and then also the United States. These games, the lottery games, are effectively raffles. It almost looks like a bingo wheel. You write your name on a ticket, you throw it in the jar, and then someone, you know, spins it around and then pulls it out. They came up with this idea because there were private companies that were doing this themselves, sort of like, oh, buy 3, I don't know, vases, get a free ticket for a drawing or something. And then basically I think it was the Venetian and the Flemish government decided that they could make money for this themselves and sort of got in on the game. And that's what sparks their spread first in Europe and then ultimately in the United States.
Did those governments outlaw their competitors or did they get in the game as a competitor of the private raffles and lotteries?
Right. Yeah. In England, it's definitely the latter where the government sort of issues a charter effectively for who can hold a lottery. And maybe I'm moving a little bit ahead, but in the United States, you know, the states would have to grant you the right to hold a lottery. You know, you'd have to appeal to the Pennsylvania legislature and say, hey, can I have a lottery? I'm trying to build a church or something. Can you, you know, give me the wheel or the licensure to do that?
Right. And like, so what I'm hearing from you is like the history of the kind of, you know, you'll encounter this at like, right, like a PTA fundraiser or a church fundraiser, right? The 50-50 raffle, like you buy raffle tickets, the money goes into a pot, they draw out a name, the name gets 50% of the revenue generated, the other 50% goes to the entity you're raising money for. That basic structure is, it sounds like really old. like that basic structure is really old, pretty popular, and has been around for centuries as a way of raising money.
Right, and really simple, if you think about it technologically, versus
yes,
something
very
like,
simple.
Like Powerball versus something like a scratch ticket, where the printing and the numbers and the management are really, really complicated and require a lot of security and sort of backroom manipulation.
Is it good at raising revenue in like 15th century Belgium?
Is anything? Yeah, I mean, I'll say they're good enough that they keep using them. So they couldn't have, you know, and especially in the colonies, but then, you know, even in England as well, you know, it's just hard to accumulate cash. It's hard to just like get cash on hand for things like construction projects. Or if you're, you know, a rich guy, this is more so true in the United States, but if you're like a rich guy who passes away and you live with a bunch of farmers and no one has enough cash to buy your land, maybe you hold a lottery instead so that somebody wins and you sort of raises enough money for the family that, you know, you're getting your money's worth from your estate.
People would do that.
Yes. And Thomas Jefferson like gives it a big thumbs up in the notes on the state of Virginia. He's like, oh, this is a tax on the willing. I think this is a great idea. It doesn't seem that much more risky to me than shipping or farming or any other sort of commercial venture.
Wait, so the idea is like you're a tenant farmer on someone's land. The actual owner dies. No one can purchase the property that's now sort of sitting there. And so all the tenant farmers together get together and have a raffle?
Or yeah, maybe the widow or something holds a raffle effectively to say to purchase the land, but nobody has, wow, you know, 15,000 pounds. I'm just making up a number to afford the estate, but everyone has £2.50 to afford a raffle ticket. And maybe one of them will become the new landlord.
And then you, as the widow, you get paid, like you get the money.
Exactly.
Money gets raised. There's one lucky winner. And then a bunch of other people are sort of like, you know, like the lottery. I mean, that's the brilliance of the lottery, right? A bunch of small dollar decisions spread over a bunch of people. It's the reason farm subsidies work, right? It's like, you know, if you're taking 80 cents from every urban dweller and then redistributing it in huge amounts to big agri interests, like you can kind of get away with it. And the lottery is doing the sort of same thing in that sense.
Right. In this case, it's by necessity, again, because the banking center, you know, London is 6 weeks away by boat. So if you can't like take out a home loan or, you know, there's, and especially if you want to fund a construction project, as I said, there's no way to just like get all that cash on hand other than taking a dollar from every single person in, you know, the city.
I mean, there's a deeper thing here and I don't want like, I guess we'll just go there and we'll see. There's a deeper thing here where it's like, why do people like to gamble?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if I can sort of raise the stakes even more, I think that there, and I have a great quote from a Las Vegas pit boss dealer, pit boss in my book about this. But basically, his theory is like, people just want to know if they're a winner or a loser. And you don't play to win. You play for like that moment when the card is going to be flipped up or that ticket is going to be drawn that's
Absolutely.
Going to reveal to you and say something about you, Chris Hayes, as a person, like you are a winner or you're just like a guy.
Yeah, there's an amazing book that I've actually been sort of obsessed with and been using for my own book. It's called Addiction by Design. Do you know this book by Natasha Schull?
Yeah, about slot machines.
Yeah, it's about slot machines. And she has these great quotes from people being like, I know I'm losing money. In the aggregate, I'm not an idiot. Like, I understand the math. I understand the casino wins. I do it because the experience of the flow state is the thing that I like. It's not about winning. It's about being in the zone of the machine. That's why I do it.
Exactly. And whatever, we can get into this epithet that lotteries are a stupid tax or a tax on people who are bad at math. And that's exactly why I hate those kind of ideas. That it's so clear that people who say those things have never played the lottery or are not regular lottery players and cannot sort of visualize what the value people get from playing.
Right. So you're right. And this is, I mean, the Econ 101 idea here is that you're purchasing some utility, right? You're purchasing an experience. The experience is, to me, what I find interesting about it. I've never been a gambler. It's like just not a vice that has its hooks in me at all. What I do understand subjectively about what's attractive about it is like, I'm very much like a schemer and plotter. Like I'm constantly thinking about like future projects. And if I'm not, I'm like, it's like a shark. You got to keep moving forward. So for me, it's like, oh, I got this project. I got this coming up. I got this coming up. I understand the delight of like, I've got this thing that might be out there. Like my life's going to change with this lottery ticket, or I put this bet on the Bulls game that might come. Like that experience of being in the interregnum of the present and the future with this kind of hopeful posture is a pleasurable one that I think is part of what people are purchasing.
Exactly. And I think that the Econ 101 story that you're normally told about lotteries is, oh, your expected dollar result is negative. You're going to lose more than you win. And therefore, it's irrational to play.
Right. Well, or that the utility function makes up the difference in the price.
Exactly.
Right. Because the expected value as a matter of math for the lottery to work has to be less than what you pay for it. Right. But what you're purchasing is the experience of a little sunshine in your pocket.
Exactly. You know, the expected value of a movie ticket is also negative, but you're getting the value of seeing the movie. But people don't see it as a form of entertainment. They really, to your point, just see it as a form of math and a matter of, you know, statistical probability.
You know, but like so many things that also get grouped under the category of vice, which is a sort of fascinating category to think about anyway. What is in vice, right? Like gambling, sex, and booze. It's also one of those things where like, it's very clear it gets out of control real easily. And I think this is true in, I know there's texts from all over the world, you know, going back a long time where various people from, you know, the prophet Muhammad to Confucius to the Old Testament have things to say about gambling because it's been with us for a long time and very clearly can get out of control real quickly.
Yeah, I'll just say very quickly, there is actually no prohibition on gambling in the Old Testament. That's sort of a common misconception, but people assume there is because evangelical Protestants are sort of the big vocal opponents.
Right, but they do talk about it, right? No, I mean, yeah. I don't mean that they prohibit it, but it is discussed as a thing that is in the world to sort of interact with.
And in 1612, King James I sort of puts a light ban on lotteries, a pause on lotteries in England because too many poor people are playing and because he thinks they're playing too much. So if, you know, a precedent for these sort of moralistic, maybe, you know, depends on what you call it, paternalistic sort of bans on gambling among the poor specifically, that goes back, you know, longer than we've ever had data on who exactly is playing the lottery.
So these are popular in the colonies, right?
Right.
Do we have them in the early parts? Like, do they keep playing that kind of role where the states are using them to raise money?
Right. So this is, I mean, some universities you might have heard of, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, you know, fund the construction of their dormitories through lotteries. And through the, let's say, 1820s, 1830s, they're pretty prevalent. And to your opening monologue, sort of in a society politically defined by an aversion to taxation, you can imagine why a lottery would be popular for these, you know, now state governments, formerly colonial governments. But then the Second Great Awakening comes along, this sort of religious revival of evangelicalism in the 1830s, 1840s, and they really sort of fall out of favor. It's weird. Some of them come back after the Civil War in some states. And then there's this one left in the 1890s. I'm moving a little quickly, but there's one left in the 1890s in Louisiana that's sort of super corrupt and selling lottery tickets all over the country. And then it finally takes Congress to intervene. And they sort of crack down on the Louisiana State Lottery Company, also known as the Golden Octopus.
Wait, tell me more of the Golden Octopus.
So there's no lotteries left, right? The year is early 1890s.
And this is because basically successful, like, virtue crusaders born on the wings of evangelical revival.
Warming up for their prohibition, for their temperance campaigns, but they start with gambling.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And so the last one left is this Louisiana State Lottery Company, again, also known as the Golden Octopus, which sells tickets all over the country. You know, you live in New York and every state between Louisiana and New York has banned lottery tickets. And yet somehow the Louisiana Lottery is selling tickets and advertising in New York.
How are they selling the tickets?
Through the mail, through agents.
Wow.
You know, like retailers. And I can't even describe how corrupt the operation of this lottery is. They make like millions in sales a year. They nominally benefit this like children's hospital in New Orleans, but it's like $5,000 on $28 million in sales. And then they brought like old school machine politics style, like just bribe their way through every Louisiana legislature to preserve their charters to sort of stay legal.
They're private. This is not a state thing.
Yeah, it's basically if we privatized the lottery today, it would be that equivalent, you know, with this promise that a certain percentage goes to this whatever hospital.
So, but just to be clear, Louisiana government is not getting any state revenue from this.
Correct.
There's just a totally private thing that's got a public charter to run this on behalf of a children's hospital, and they're selling $28 million of tickets and giving the children's hospital like $5,000.
Or maybe it's $50,000, but yeah, it's like some penance compared to the overall amount. And then who knows? I mean, it's the 1890s, right? Who knows if these prizes are ever given out? Like, you know, there's no way to know if you live in Chicago, someone in Boston, you hear, read in the paper, someone in Boston won the lottery.
Right,
that could just be made up. Like, maybe these guys are just pocketing the money.
Right. Oh, so it's just not even clear that there's even a payout.
Yeah, I mean, this is also true of what's called the Dublin sweepstakes, which is sort of an Irish-based lottery that happens. Except my mom claims that, like, the superintendent of her building in Queens won the Dublin sweepstakes, and that's what let him buy the apartment. That's the only evidence I have that anyone ever won the Irish sweepstakes and that ever any prize was ever actually given out.
Wait, okay, so, you know, let's finish Louisiana and go to Dublin. So what brings its downfall? Like, how does it get so out of control?
So, again, it's bribing its way through these legislatures to preserve its charter, keep its monopoly. And then finally, Congress has to step in because the Louisiana State Legislature is just like literally bought and sold by this company.
And because it's become other people's problem, presumably, right?
Exactly.
Like if all these people are buying tickets in all these different states and no one's ever winning, you start to hear about it.
And these states have banned lotteries. So they're like, oh, surely our people are safe. You know, they can't buy lottery tickets anymore. And then here comes the Golden Octopus, named sort of for a tentacular reach, you know, into the furthest reaches of the country. So Congress basically cracks down on interstate lottery advertising. They crack down on the interstate transportation of gambling paraphernalia, like anything like a lottery wheel or something you can't move across straight lines. And this is important for two reasons. First, these regulations go to the Supreme Court and are upheld in Champion v. Ames, which, you know, law students out there will know is sort of the Supreme Court decision that holds up Congress's ability to regulate interstate commerce. That's one big one. And then second, you know, flash forward 60, 70 years when these first state-run lotteries start up, these laws are still on the books and are huge problems. that really slow down the development of the games because, you know, the New York Times can't advertise the New York Lottery and then sell a paper in Connecticut with a New York State Lottery advertisement in it because there's this interstate law targeting Louisiana from the 1890s.
That's wild. So it does stamp it out, though.
Yes. Well, they moved to Honduras and Havana and they try. It's just not really? As big. Yeah.
They slay the golden octopus, get the old golden octopus to go offshore.
Right. And there's really nothing they can do there, but there's no way they're going to have as big of a reach, you know, without the protection of a American state legislature.
So wait, what was the Dublin one, though? Is that more recent?
This is like 19. So basically what we get after that is this a wave of illegal gambling. And then there's sort of two sides to this story. One are black numbers games in urban Northeast and Rust Belt cities. And the other one, more popular among white working class people who also play the numbers a little bit, is a sweepstakes based in Ireland. I think also nominally benefiting a hospital of some kind, but they sell tickets all over the country. And again, I guess my mom knew someone who won it once.
Wait, in the US?
In the US, yeah.
So wait, so basically the whole thing, the kind of lottery world and the sort of gambling world goes underground post 1890.
Right.
And it's bifurcated by race. People know about, I think, probably the numbers. It's, you know, in black neighborhoods in Harlem. And Malcolm X in his autobiography talks a lot about the numbers running because he was sort of involved in that. And that's just basically a lottery, right? I mean, there's like numbers and you choose them. And then if you hit them, you get paid out.
Yeah, it's a daily lottery, right? Versus Louisiana, which is like monthly or whatever. And it's like a 3 or 4 digit game rather than a longer thing. And there's this ingenious mechanism where if you know where to look in the newspaper every day, you can see what the number drawing was. And you can play, this is really important, you can play for as little as like a couple pennies. You can like bet a nickel or something. You don't need to, you know, shell out a full dollar, $2, whatever, for a full ticket. You can, you know, really, really play. Basically, the poor, it's much more accessible to the poor in a real way.
Wow. And are these interconnected from city to city? Or are there numbers outfits that run each city?
So the number itself is drawn, right? It might be like the last 3 digits of the New York Stock Exchange for the day. And it might be that the numbers in Detroit and Cleveland and Boston all use that same number.
That would be like a kind of thing. That would be like an example of how the numbers would be drawn.
Exactly. Or there was some crazy formula where it's like the 3rd digit from this horse race track handle and then the 4th digit from that horse race. But if you're in the know, you're in the know.
Right. And what's cool about that, or smart and ingenious, is that it is transparent, right? It's a publicly accessible, known in advance number that will appear tomorrow that will also be random.
Right. Not that it didn't stop people from like trying to like camp out at the New York Stock Exchange and like telegraph the number to Chicago before someone could call and like get the number. You know, there's all these like wacky stories from the 1920s of people trying to do that.
It's like the Flash Boys, right? It's like the nanosecond micro trading. Like they're trying to like basically get the info. They're trying to arbitrage on the time it takes for the info to travel.
Right. But the year is 1912 and exactly.
So tell me about the Dublin one. So I'm familiar with the numbers, but the Dublin one is one that white working class folks or poor white people in America are playing, is their version of the numbers, but it's run out of Dublin?
Yeah. And I think as far as I can tell, it's still sort of a raffle structure. Again, there's sort of the technology to do something like a Powerball where you actually get numbers and you can play your own numbers. That's really hard and really sort of requires a lot of technological proficiency. As far as I can tell, you like write your name on a little slip or something and they draw you and then you'll get a letter maybe or like maybe a fat envelope in a couple weeks or months or more likely never that says, hey, by the way, you won the lottery. Here's $10,000 or something. So I don't want to say that the player base is that big. I mean, I think in places like New York, it was very popular. But what's important here, as with the numbers, is that the lottery doesn't like fade from public consciousness. And then as state legislatures are starting to warm up to the idea of a legal state lottery, we all know about the lottery. Everyone plays the Dublin sweepstakes or plays the numbers. And that's what sort of keeps it top of mind. And it's not like, oh, let's legalize heroin. And people are like, what? We've never had legal heroin, but we've always sort of had lotteries sort of at arm's breadth throughout American history.
So what brings about the kind of modern era of the lottery?
Yeah, so it starts in New Hampshire, you know, maybe not surprisingly, which in the 1960s was one of only 3 states without a sales or an income tax. And I argue, you know, many possible interpretations, but that in the immediate post-World War II period, you know, 1950s, there's sort of this golden moment, as you well know, of sort of economic exceptionalism. We can have larger state governments, more services without more taxes to pay for them. And then lo and behold, Vietnam, inflation, stagflation, that comes sort of crashing to a halt. And state governments sort of need to buttress their budgets. And these voters don't want to pay more for the services that they already enjoy. So that's sort of one big factor. That's a big one, I think, that sort of explains why 60s and 70s is when that first wave comes in.
And is there a big fight over it?
Yeah, the federal government hates it. They like hate the New Hampshire lottery. They do all this. There's this crazy story, like they're trying to move that, remember that old 1890s law against gambling paraphernalia? Like the New Hampshire Lottery pays to have their wheels built in, like, I don't remember where, let's say Chicago, and the federal government won't let them transport into New Hampshire across state lines because it's sort of like marijuana legalization under the Trump administration, where states might decide that it's legal, but the federal government doesn't have to and doesn't have to take a supportive position if they don't want to. And the games are also crazy, but we can get into that. Just their design is just absolutely insane.
Well, tell me.
Well, so there's still on the books a 10% excise tax on all gambling not associated with horse racing.
This is in New Hampshire or federally?
A federal. Okay. There's a federal carve out for horse racing.
Okay. So the federal regime that they're under is, but for horse racing, any gambling is subject to a 10% federal excise tax.
Yeah, which at the time really just applies to bingo, because bingo games are sort of being legalized. You know, your local church bingo game, which was happening underground anyway, but those are being legalized in the 50s and 60s. And so as a result, New Hampshire is like, oh, we don't want to pay that 10% tax. So they have this crazy raffles like scheme where you draw a ticket, but it's not actually, you know, your name that's drawn of who the winner is. It's like you draw the number of a horse and then you do a separate drawing for the number of a horse race. So it's technically affiliated with, like, oh, if we look in the digest, right, the horse race digest from 1942, then in the seventh race, it was the sixth horse that won. And oh, Bobby Smith has the seventh horse from the sixth race. She wins $600,000 in the lottery.
Wow. So they piggyback, their random generator was piggybacking off of random horse stuff because that would get them out of the excise tax.
Right, with an occasional actual live horse race just to sort of build up excitement. But also this is, as you can imagine, you know, horse racing is known as the sport of kings, right? So they're trying to build legitimacy, like cultural legitimacy for the game. And then the other big one, just to tie back to the numbers and the organized crime's reputation for sort of getting involved in gambling economy, is they don't want to be seen as corrupt and they want to remove any possibility that these games are rigged. And, you know, the first director of the New Hampshire Lottery is a former FBI agent, not someone who like knows about games, because of the, you know, the Kefauver hearings and his fears that organized crime is going to infiltrate state lotteries in the way that it did Nevada casinos.
Right. And Kefauver hearings are these big hearings that were by a senator from Tennessee, fascinating liberal senator who sort of went after the mob.
Yeah.
Also the mob's collaboration with legitimate business in these big high profile hearings.
And that had more viewers in 1951 than the World Series. You know, more people watched the Kefauver hearings than the World Series.
Wow.
And he, you know, Estes Kefauver has this sort of formula where his idea that he imparts is gambling isn't just something that the mob does. Gambling is what makes the money that lets the mob do all this other stuff. So if you want to cut out prostitution or drugs or whatever, you have to go after gambling, is his idea, not just sort of treat gambling as one of these other factors.
More of our conversation after this quick break.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Was the gambling run by organized crime, whether, you know, the mafia or, you know, black organized crime in urban environments, were they rigged or were they running legitimate lottery games?
Depends who you ask. In some cases, all the organized crime is doing is backing local operators. So like, you know, Chris, you run a little numbers games for your friends, you know, maybe a couple hundred people in your neighborhood. And if too many people bet on the number 666 one day, for example, you would offload some of that risk onto your local mobster. Right. So because you would be wiped out financially if that number came through. But then in some places, you know, in Boston, it's like Whitey Bulger and Dutch, you know, he actually runs the game, like Tony Soprano style. So it depends. It's really a city by city case as to sort of how involved and integrated into that gambling economy they are on a day-to-day basis.
But the point is, like, there's an association in people's minds in the 50s and 60s and going into the 70s when we get the lottery birth of, like, gambling with illicit activity.
I mean, exactly.
Like, there's both a memory of it as, like, legitimate and sort of in a gray area, but also illicit, right? It's sort of both.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's very local, but, and then that's where the logic comes in of, oh, all this stuff is happening anyway, we might as well legalize it, which is another sort of factor inspiring the rise of state-run games.
Right, which is very similar to the argument that people, you know, pushing to legalize illegal drugs, particularly marijuana, have made for years, right? Like, people are going to use marijuana on the scale of things that are harmful. It's like, not super harmful. There's things that are more harmful. Arguably, a lot of people argue, and I think somewhat persuasively, alcohol is. And, you know, prohibition only pushes it underground. Market demand is going to be met by illicit forces. So let's bring it out into the, you know. Now, the next step, though, would be like, okay, New York State is going to be the sole monopoly seller of weed, right?
Right, right.
Which is what ends up happening in the lottery situation, right? So New Hampshire launches the lottery, and is it a big success that generates a lot of revenue and states start clamoring, or?
States do clamor, but not because it's a big success. So New York gets in the game, sort of modeled off of New Hampshire's. They also have this weird sort of horse race drawing formula. And then it's New Jersey. I mean, of course, it's New Jersey that really sort of figures it out. And they add weekly drawings, not just like a drawing every 4 months or whenever the, you know, people bet a certain amount. They have this weekly drawing plus an occasional horse race drawing. That's how they get around this excise tax until it gets repealed. And then ultimately 1974, Massachusetts is when we get scratch tickets. And then the following year is when we get legal daily numbers games. And that's when we're off and running. 1978, we get Lotto, which is the precursor to Powerball, Mega Millions. Now we're sort of really cooking with gas and playing sort of real games that people will actually enjoy.
My cause and effect story in the opening, which is about the explosion of this, is about sort of revenue and the tax revolt, which I think is generally checks out. But this is all happening kind of before that. So what happens in those years that get us the legalization terrain that then can explode once the sort of tax revolt happens?
Yeah, so that first wave is happening a lot. Again, it's happening in the Northeast and Rust Belt because these are the states where the numbers games are. So this is where people are, quote unquote, already gambling. And so state, quote unquote, might as well legalize. And then there's the phenomenon of, which you also see nowadays with marijuana, of, oh, Connecticut or Massachusetts already has a lottery. So people in Connecticut are already gambling. They're just betting in Massachusetts. We might as well legalize it ourselves.
Right. Right.
So that's where you, if you look at the map, it's really like all of the Northeast and Rust Belt plus Illinois. And then that's it. And then they stop. Dead in their tracks in 1977, right before the tax revolt that you mentioned.
But the federal government repeals the excise tax.
Yeah, so 1975, 1976 is when they repeal the excise tax. They repeal this advertising restriction that they repeal the advertising over state lines. They basically get out of the way. And that's basically been their posture towards lotteries since then.
Are the state lotteries sold as specifically going to be about education funding in the beginning?
No, it's even worse than that. They're sold as like, we are going to solve every tax problem this state has ever had and will ever have for history. They are like a panacea, silver bullet for everything. Again, because the ironic consequence of these Kefauver hearings and all these other hearings is, oh, look at how profitable illegal gambling is. Surely if we legalize it for ourselves, we'll never have to pay taxes again. Or we can, there's a quote from a New Jersey congressman, we can increase every service in this state fourfold. Is what he says. Does not turn out that way, but they don't even need to bother to designate it specifically for education because it's going to solve education and all their other problems too.
And then what happens in terms of the actual revenue versus the revenue projections?
Yeah, so it just goes into the general fund and it's doesn't make a difference, but it does sort of set the stage, and we can hold on this for a second, but for this next wave that's going to start in Western states in the 80s that are going to not tie the lottery to the whole general fund and to the whole state, but are going to tie it exactly, as you said, to sort of one specific state program. You know, education, public parks, you know, police services, because the panacea for the whole state doesn't work. Maybe a panacea for one program will work instead.
And it doesn't work. Why? Because there's just not enough revenue?
Yeah. And well, ironically, the New Jersey lottery in its first year in 1969, sort of based on the projections that were hoped for, they actually are meeting those projections today. If you translate, you know, 1969 dollar projections of $500 million, that's actually, you know, they're getting pretty close to that in terms of billions of dollars today. But the number of games and the variety of games that they offered in 1969 was never, ever going to get to what you have today, which is, you know, as you said, every type of scratch ticket, every type of lotto game, every type of daily drawing game. So based on the style of games, it was absolutely insane style of production. Today, now that we have all this amazing technology and printing and companies that sort of force lottery tickets on people's throat, it's a lot more accurate.
So then there's another wave in the 80s.
Yeah.
Why do we get this other wave and how long does it take for every state to get one?
Right. So this other wave is driven by this company, Scientific Games Incorporated, which basically AstroTurfs its way to lotteries. Then they advertise on behalf of the lottery and it works. And then they also, you know, you'll be shocked to hear, write the law in such a way that they're all but guaranteed to receive the lottery contract to print the tickets once the lottery is in effect.
So is there one, there's like one lottery company operating with all these contracts?
There are a couple, but there's only one that's has the chutzpah to like really like write the law in such a way that's self-beneficial. Wow. And is willing to invest and sort of, I guess, risk the money to pay for these initiatives up front without a technical guarantee that they're going to receive the contract.
But they win.
But they win, and then they all, of course, they win the contracts. Yeah. And that, just to your point about sort of this inevitability of gambling, oh, gambling is going to happen anyway, that's when, once all these states legalize, and four states, it's California, Oregon, Missouri, and West Virginia, pass lotteries on election day 1984, that's when basically states are like, all right, this is going to come for us anyway, so if we're not going to get in early, we might as well get in early. The exception of that is southern states, which we can put for the final wave, but that's when the rest of the Midwest is and West just gets on board.
And the final waves are southern states where essentially the religious evangelical opposition to gambling is strongest.
Yeah, and Alabama's still holding out. You know, Mississippi fell in 2018. There are a couple others sort of holdouts still. You know, Utah, you'll be shocked to hear. But yeah, and we can talk about this. The panacea has a final wave, a final iteration, where in the western states, you have a panacea, not for the whole state budget, but for one line item in the state budget. And then, I don't know if you're familiar with the Hope Scholarship in Georgia, but the premise, yep, that any student, in-state student with a sufficiently high GPA can go to any in-state university for free. That sort of brings the panacea down to the family level and say, oh, the lottery will pay for your kid to go to school. You just have to pass it first.
The Hope Scholarship, which was the sort of signature policy achievement of a governor named Zell Miller, who would then be a Democratic senator and then very famously switch over to the Republicans. He once challenged Chris Matthews to a duel live on air after he gave a nominating speech for George W. Bush in 2004 at the RNC.
The only person to give the keynote address at both the DNC and the RNC.
Right. But that Hope Scholarship was huge and hugely popular. Basically said, if your kid gets a B, or as they say in the South, makes a B, then they get to go to a state school for free.
Yep.
Right? Tuition free.
Right. And it's a merit scholarship, right? Which, as folks may be able to intuit, inherently is it privileges richer, whiter,
yep,
you know, students. And you'll be shocked to hear it is not richer, whiter families that are buying the lottery tickets, right, that are funding, right, the Hope Scholarship in the first place.
Right, right, right. So it's a subterranean, both sort of class and racial transfer that's happening from poorer Black folks to more affluent white folks.
Yeah, and you'll be shocked to hear that other states love what's happening in Georgia, in the South specifically. And, you know, other states have either, you know, including Louisiana, have either lottery-funded scholarships or sort of just merit scholarships in general, because, you know, the Hope Scholarship is so successful and wins the Miller two terms as governor.
Well, let's segue into the distributional effects here, right? I mean, there's different distributional effects of different kinds of revenue. The income tax, which some states have a flat income tax, some states have graduated income taxes. Then there's consumption taxes, sales taxes, which tend to be relatively regressive. Poor people spend much larger percentage of their income on consumption than they, right, do wealthy people. There are property taxes, which ends up happening often in the absence of state funding, right? So when you're funding education, the sort of lower, the less state funding you're getting, the more you're going to have rely on property taxes. Property taxes in a place like Texas, for instance, which is a very low tax state at the state level, has very high property taxes in a lot of places to make up for that revenue. So there's different distributional, you know, effects of different revenue raising methods. What's the general distributional story of the lottery?
Well, the real story is that it's small. We shouldn't even be putting lotteries in the same sentence as like a property tax or an income tax, because we're talking about like 2.5% of state revenue total,
right,
in such a way that, especially if it's designated for a specific program like in Georgia, but we're really like talking about orders of magnitude differences. And in some states, you know, Illinois, you know, your beloved Illinois, they love to say, oh, it's the fourth largest source of state revenue. Yeah, but the first one is like sales tax. And then the second one is, right, income. It's like there's a big, pretty big drop off between number three and number four in basically every state.
We'll be right back after we take this quick break.
Thank you.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
So how big are lotteries and how much should we, do they matter and how much should we care, right? Because at some level, it's like they're a little bit of a bait and switch that is going to solve all these revenue problems and we won't have to raise taxes. But then the fact that they don't deliver on that promise means that like they're not actually that big. Like, are they really hurting anyone?
Well, so it's a really important distinction between on the consumer side and then on the state side, where the impact on the government is very, very small because as a share of the money that states make, it's a very small percentage. But as a share of the discretionary spending that a lot of poor people have,
of course,
right?
Of course,
you'll be, you know, it counts suddenly for a lot of money for a lot of people.
Well, that gets us to the distribution story here. Yeah. So, like, what is it? Who's it coming from? And can they afford it? I guess is the question.
Right. So, you know, 1 in 8 Americans buys a lottery ticket once a week.
That's high.
Yeah, it's a lot. 50% once a year.
Right.
As long as they share their winnings with me, that's fine.
I was talking to my mom on the phone before I came to this interview and was telling her who I was having on the podcast. And I was just like, I can't imagine. I mean, I know this sounds different and I'm in a very, very lucky position where I'm not, you know, stressed about money all the time. $1 billion sounds like a nightmare. Like,
yeah.
But I mean, obviously it sounds like if you're stressed about money, it's like all of that stress is going to go away and you're worried about your mom who needs 24-hour care that Medicaid is not paying for and you got debt and you, I mean, so like 100%. Understand it, but like in real terms, that seems like a nightmare.
Well, I have good news. I have two pieces of good news. First, you're not going to win. And second, it's only $700 million after taxes. So that's like a lot more manageable. So just to answer your distributional question. So the top 20 to 30% of lottery players account for as much as 70 to 80% of lottery sales.
Mm, wow.
And that group, that 20 to 30% is disproportionately non-white, less educated, and lower income. And male, actually, is sort of another quality. And I think, very importantly, it's actually not the sort of very, very bottom, you know, the lowest quintile of wealth. It's that second quintile of wealth. You know, folks at the very bottom just don't have the discretionary spending to buy enough tickets. It's that next group that has the discretionary spending but perceives a lack of opportunity in the economy. And they reason, falsely, but the reason, they have just as good odds of winning the Mega Millions, odds 1 in 302 million, as they do of, you know, getting out, getting up, having a new life through their job.
Yeah. I mean, we should also say that like that 80-20 power law distribution, which you see a lot, like, you know, that's, I think alcohol sales are like that. I think casinos run on those, right? Like a relatively small percentage of people accounting for the vast majority of the revenue. That is not distinct to lotteries. I mean, casinos, as far as I know, and I think alcohol sales also operate roughly along those lines.
Right. But the difference being that Smirnoff is not a state-run agency. Casinos are not done at the behest of the state government.
Right. How much has this grown through the years?
Yeah, lottery sales. So just to go back to 1964, New Hampshire, we had one state and $5.7 million in sales. As of last year, we had 45 states and $98 billion in sales, which as recently as, let's say, 10 years ago, 2014, Americans spent more money on lottery tickets than on books, sports tickets, video games, music, and movie tickets combined.
Wow.
So, and the lottery sales have grown, I think it's like 18 of the last 20 years or something. And they just, until COVID, were, you know, setting records every year. And there's just this never-ending appetite among legislators for more gambling money. You know, they're never going to say no to more tax-free revenue. So, you know, lottery commissions have their job is to make more money for states, as much money as they can.
And now we've also seen like the adjacent thing, which is it's like lotteries weren't enough. And now we see the growth of legalized gambling, state-sanctioned legalized gambling, which is not like direct funding usually, but it is it'll be taxed at very high rates with basically the same promise. So, you know, casinos, you know, started with riverboat casinos, and then it's downtown casinos. Now it's like New York's talking about it, like, I don't know, like a downtown casino in New York strikes me as insane.
Well, they are, and then now they're gonna, I mean, I don't know if New York is there, but, you know, sports betting on your phone, right? Which is actually, you know, in the way that that lotteries set the stage for sports gambling set the stage for now lottery tickets on your phone.
Oh, lottery tickets on your phone.
Yeah.
Does that exist yet?
In 7 states, it does.
I gotta say, I know this is like slightly adjacent, but like the sports betting on the phone just seems like really dangerous. Like so dangerous. Maybe I'm being, I don't know if I'm being prudish here or just sort of middle-aged dad-ish, but like, I don't know, man. I think you want some slightly higher levels of transactional friction than like clicking around on your phone, putting 7 different prop bets and parlays on the night's suite of league pass games on the NBA, which like, I will say as someone who like, it does not tempted by gambling and doesn't gamble, itself is like kind of enticing to me as someone who doesn't even gamble.
Right.
Like you're sitting there, watch the game, put a little action on it. Like you press a few buttons. It's like, I don't know. Seems dangerous.
And I can't remember if it's FanDuel or DraftKings, but the tagline, like basically make the games more fun or you know, it's totally right. And I will say just in terms of adding more friction, I would love to see the same thing for like Robinhood or crypto, other things you can do on your phone.
Totally.
Where there's little barrier and you could lose so much money so fast.
Yeah. I mean, like you're right. The make the games more fun is like, you know, it's 11:45 on the East Coast and you, Chris Hayes, are watching a league pass battle between the Orlando Magic and the Sacramento Kings.
First of all, why are you doing this? The Kings are good, but why, you know, but why?
It's good for my brain. It like it weirdly calms my brain down, but it's like, well, you know, put a little, like I have no rooting interest in the Kings or the Magic, but like, I don't know, put $20 on it. Like,
and as my wife found out the first time we went to a casino and watched the Western Conference Finals between the Warriors and the Rockets, like you put $5, $20 on a game, you all of a sudden have the most rooting interest you've ever had in the game in your entire life.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like you can see, I mean, I guess what it comes back to, right, is like, okay, so there's like a distributional aspect to the lottery. And then there's this like, this sense of like having a wild animal on a leash, right? That is gambling and its primal force and like using that, the wild animal to get you to where you want to go, but always worried that they're going to escape, right?
Yeah.
And it feels like that. It definitely feels that to me right now with sports gambling, but there is this also just this incentive for constant growth that I don't know when it ever hits up against any kind of limit.
Well, it doesn't. And, you know, talk about being off the leash. I think, you know, if you've read that New York Times and the Bloomberg reporting on the sports gambling industry, I think these companies, both lotteries and sports betting, the foxes are in the hen house,
right, you
know, in terms of lobbying and getting states to add more games, to add more variety, to make things cheaper, to break down regulatory barriers, you name it. They own us hook, line, and sinker already.
Should we abolish the lottery?
I think it's time. I don't think it's going to happen.
You think we should get rid of state lotteries?
I think we do. I think we should. The gambling will continue. I make no, you know, jokes about that. You know, people are going to keep betting, but there is no way, you know, without the cooperation of a state government or these companies, that Americans are going to bet $98 billion a year on lottery tickets. And, you know, the 5%, 1% of players are still going to find a way to play. But ultimately, these games are not serving the common good. And in fact, I think are doing more harm than good overall.
Well, wait, let's go back to the original point you were making about sort of against the sort of paternalist banning, right?
Yeah.
That like this idea that like it's a tax on people that, you know, can't calculate expected value. But people are getting some utility out of it. And, you know, people can choose how to spend their disposable income however they want. It's not like cigarettes. It doesn't have a tangible physical harm to people.
Right.
So it's not in the same category. And it's not even like, honestly, it's not even like a, you know, alcohol, which is, you know, probably more dangerous for you in a physical sense than like buying a bunch of lottery tickets. So like, what's the harm?
Right. So I don't think, you'll be shocked to hear, you know, I don't think we should like ban lotteries and then criminalize them. And anyone found with a number slip in their pocket, like needs to go to jail. Like, you know, we did for a long time with weed. You know, I just don't think we need the cooperation of state governments in enticing people to gamble and having a financial stake in enticing more people to gamble more money. So I suffer no illusion that any state is actually going to ban its lottery. I think the more realistic and maybe even better solution is that states just pare them down to sort of their barest elements without sort of enticing and without luring a new generation of people to play, so that there is gambling available, but not in such a way that it's going to warp your perception about your odds of a new life. Mm-hmm. It's not going to addict people. You know, addiction by design, you know, estimates that as many as 1% of American adults qualify as having a gambling disorder. That's not going to exacerbate those problems. And ultimately, you know, young people don't seem to be interested in lotteries anyway. So hopefully, sort of over time, the games just fade away.
Oh, is there a big cohort effect here?
Yeah. And I mean, my thesis, you know, totally unprovable and impossible to know, is that these younger generations are just, you know, they're doing crypto or they're doing Robinhood or they're doing sports betting instead. Like, why would you play a game that's total absolute chance when you can play a different, equally chance game, but at least gives you the perception of being smarter than everybody else?
Right.
And that's just as accessible on your phone.
Right. And there's also like the lottery, the sheer randomness of the lottery doesn't create a kind of like adjacent industry of like faux beat the market knowledge that, you know, the sports gambling, it's like there's so many people being like, you know, offering their like special prop cocktail of views of like, take the dogs on, you know,
take
the dogs on the road, every dog on the road and whatever it is, like underdog on the road, you know.
Or the Georgia Bulldogs, you know.
Or the Georgia Bulldogs, which was, yes. The
Georgia
Bulldogs, the Georgia Bulldogs to cover was a good bet.
Yeah. So you can feel lucky and you can feel chosen, but you can't feel smart with lotteries.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. That's interesting. So you think it's just a displacement effect, but then the problem is the natural one-way ratchet of this is like, aren't the state lotteries going to come back with some weird version of their own thing that feels like it has some, you know?
Yeah. Or more likely a company is going to create it and sell it, you know, and get a state on board to add it. But this has been a long trend. States introduced scratch tickets in the 70s because it was a bunch of old people buying these old raffle tickets and they couldn't get young people to play. So they added scratch tickets. And then these big Powerball, you know, Mega Millions type jackpots, also sort of another gateway drug in the 80s and 90s to get younger people to play. Now they need a new gateway drug. For now, it's been online ticket sales, which, again, we'll see if they are able to compete with these other ventures that we've already described. More likely, I'll have to write another book in 20 years because there'll be some other new wave and the lotteries of today will look as equally as quaint and ridiculous as the lottery of New Hampshire from 1964.
I mean, the thing that I weirdly keep coming back to is just, and maybe like, I don't know if I'm just in this intellectual mode recently or just like the way I'm thinking of just like, there's just something fundamental in us, right? The games of chance and our draw to it is, it's with us, man. And I guess, you know, it's obviously it's historically, culturally, institutionally constructed, right? There are places that gamble more or less, but man, does it feel like a real primal part of us.
Totally. And that's totally fair. You know, the 1976 Gambling Commission, their opening words of their final report are gambling is inevitable. And I think that's right. But it's not inevitable that we go to $98 billion a year. You know, it's not inevitable that we have these companies that just push and push and push more tickets down people's throats and that the state sort of uses its imprimatur of legitimacy to sell these tickets.
Are the contractors competitive now? Like, are there a bunch of different companies in this space that are getting different state contracts and competing with each other? Or is it pretty like, you know, defense contracting?
Yeah, there's two big ones, basically. Scientific Games, which I mentioned, and then IGT, formerly known as G-Tech, that started as sort of the purveyor of Mega Millions Powerball type games tickets. And now they just sort of bounce back and forth. The industry's gotten a lot more, it used to be more fun. In the 80s and 90s, they would like sue each other all the time and they would like try to crack each other's tickets to prove that the security wasn't good. And now they just like make their money and go home. Yeah.
So they just have a duopoly basically.
Yeah. I mean, there are other companies, but Scientific Games, as far as I can tell, has 30 plus of the 45 ticket contracts to print instant tickets and then 70% of the global market for instant tickets. So not just US American lotteries, but scratch tickets like all over in all, countries all over the world.
What do other countries do about this?
So other countries have lotteries, some of which sort of rival the US. And just to your point about sort of this inexorable American desire to gamble, I think Australia rivals us as far as I can tell in sort of their appetite for betting. But in countries like China—
Well, no one can beat the Chinese.
Right.
I mean, that is a place in a culture where gambling is incredibly, incredibly central.
Right. Less so the lottery there, but
yeah.
Both China and Taiwan sort of have this unique arrangement where the lottery sort of split into two. There's like a lottery sort of as we know it. And then there's also, it's called like the sports lottery, but it's really just sports betting, but it's run under the lottery administration. I think the best example here are countries like Spain and Italy, which have these equally gratuitous, massive jackpots, you know, couple million, many millions, many billions, whatever, but the distribution is totally different. Whereas, you know, the jackpot that was won in November was won by one person, whereas the Spanish lottery will be won by like 14,000 people, each of whom get like 1.8 million or something, in a way that is totally indicative, I think, of the sort of individualistic structure that we have
so
on our
wild.
Games.
Yeah. That also just makes so much more sense and seems so much better.
It does, except the American lotteries used to do this and they've just, and people basically wanted bigger prizes.
Oh yeah, no, totally. I think it's totally demand driven. Absolutely. Yeah. I think people want to like buy the ticket for the 5 billion higher, bigger, more.
Right.
But it as a policy matter or just as a, it just seems like a better arrangement.
Yeah.
There's also, I remember like my uncle used to play some foreign lottery, but it was like a lottery for people that had a lot of money. So like the tickets were like $1,000 or something. And that always struck me as interesting. And like, maybe that would be better like distributionally.
Right. Well, going back a long way, this is how you get the numbers games, which started as something called policy, which started as a game called the insurance policy, because poor Black people basically couldn't afford a full lottery ticket because it was like $2.50. And I'm talking like 1812 when $2.50 was a lot of money. So you'd buy like a share of a ticket or a fraction of a fraction of a ticket. And that ultimately became a game in and of itself. But that basically used to be the case in the, you know, in early American history. The tickets were the equivalent of like a luxury good. And only recently,
wow,
you know, relatively speaking, have they become sort of more democratized and more accessible. A lesson we learned from numbers games.
Man, it's so funny. The more I read and think about like that word democratize, like, which has a kind of like obviously positive valence, but then it's always like some, like, it's just like the favorite word of like incredibly nefarious actors trying to sell something. We're going to we're democratizing crypto. We're democratizing
right. Democratizing like, gambling addiction. Yeah. Won't that be
yeah,
fun?
Right, yeah, right. Exactly. Like now everyone can have access to this. Jonathan Cohn is author of For a Dollar and a Dream, State Lotteries in Modern America. He's a program officer at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I learned so much during that hour. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks. And good luck, everyone.
As always, great thanks to our guest, Jonathan Cohn. I learned a lot there. Did you know about lotteries in the colonial era? I did not. That was great. Tweet us with a hashtag withpod, email withpod@gmail.com. And as always, be sure to follow us on TikTok by searching for withpod. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by Donnie Holloway and Brendan O'Melia, engineered by Bob Mallory, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.